Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest roaring edition of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, how are you this fine day?
Yeah, good, thank you, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, doing pretty well. And we just kick this one off by reminding our millions of listeners out there that this will be the last one we do before we take a break in August. I want to thank everybody for all the support we've had during the lockdown, the pandemic, the way we've had to set up studios in our own offices and homes and all that. And they've stuck by us. So I can only say a very big thank you. And normal service will resume in September.
So what will you be doing on your August break?
Well, I haven't precisely planned it yet, but it will be, to all intents and purposes, a tour of Britain. I want to get to those places I haven't been able to go to. I think I've mentioned this before. I want to go back to Chester, stay at the Grosvenor Hotel in Chester. I want to go to the northeast, to Tynemouth and Whitley Bay. I'm not going to go down to Devon and Cornwall because, frankly, that's too crowded now. And
everybody's down there. It's mad, isn't it? You can't even get in.
Yeah, but I might just do something, you know, right out of sort of left wing and go to either the Lake District or to East Anglia, to what's all that water in East Anglia called? I've forgotten.
Sea?
No, not the sea. No, they've got the Inland Lakes, haven't they? You know, Norfolk Broads.
The Broads. I only found out relatively recently that the Broads are man-made. I didn't know that.
Well, I didn't, I must admit. But there is an awful lot of man-made waterways in this country. I mean, the canal system was really what helped generate the Industrial Revolution when we started building canals between the Midlands and the Northwest, because the Northwest was the powerhouse of the world, because that's where all the cotton was spun and all the industry was, and, you know, it was coal mining and all that kind of stuff. So you had to transport all that somehow across Britain in the absence of motorways and all that kind of stuff, and it was the canals, which, of course, are still there today.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I hadn't realised, of course, that the Broads were also canals dug into the peat, which reminded me of our mutual friend, Mr. Taverner, who we were having a conversation years ago about the most unusual jobs we'd done before we became journalists.
Right.
And one of his jobs had been as a peat cutter down in the West Country.
Really?
And another one, this one used to make me die. He was a Stilton stabber.
Stilton stabber?
Which sounds like a euphemism, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know how the Stiltons get their blue veins, that sort of very distinctive colour?
Yeah.
They put long copper spikes into the big wheels of the cheese while it's standing in the warehouse.
Right.
And it's the introduction of the copper that makes the blue veins appear in the white cheese.
God, remind me never to eat Stilton cheese again. I didn't realise.
Because Mr. Tavern has been at it with his copper stabber.
Where was Roger from? Was he from Luton?
No, his family lived in Luton sort of latterly, but he was from Somerset.
Somerset, that's right. Of course he was, West Country, yeah. I had a few really odd jobs as, like, a student and, you know, a schoolboy. I mean, I started off as a paper boy, then I was a milkman. I worked on the Corona pop wagon. But the most unusual job I had was marking out fields for a helicopter that was spraying the crops. What I had to do is I had to hold a red flag up at the edge of the field. The helicopter would come in, spray the crops, and me, by the way. I got covered in all sorts of chemicals. Then I had to sprint 50 yards with my red flag to mark the next channel for the helicopter as it went up, bank, turn around and came back down again. And I was told I was the most brilliant marker because I always used to spot the telephone wires used to be all over the country in those days. And I apparently had very, very good eyesight to spot telephone wires.
That's quite a big responsibility for a young chap, isn't it? A helicopter can so easily fall out of the sky.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I said. I said, I am the only thing between a helicopter crashing into telephone wires and the safety of the pilot. And they said, yeah, basically that's it. There's no other way of doing it. You know, concentrate on looking for the telephone wires. But
you should have had danger money for that.
Yeah, well, I should have had danger money if you're getting covered in all the all the goddamn chemicals. Something about chemicals.
It could explain a lot, you know.
It could. Agent Orange, if you see what I mean. You know, the Vietnamese things, which somebody's written a book about, horrific stuff. But, no, talking about chemicals, I then took another job on holiday, I remember, where I was spraying railway platforms with weed killer, right, to keep the, you know, the weeds down on the platform. The only reason I did that, because it was a horrible job, you know, the chemicals, again, smelt awful and all that. But I got my own truck. I got my own chemical truck. And so I had a new girlfriend at the time. She wasn't that impressed when I came round the first night to take her out with the chemical truck. And we went off to some country pub, you know, in Cheshire. And I have to say, my vehicle was quite outstanding in the car park alongside the old MGB roadsters, you know.
You probably poisoned the poor girl with all these chemicals pouring off you and sweating away in the moonlight.
Well, you know, we won't go into that. Now, Jones.
We always go into that.
Oh, absolutely right. I noticed that Selfridges is up for sale. It's going to be sold for £4.5 billion. It's owned by the Western family of America. Long time since it was owned by Mr. Selfridge. But I think I've only been in Selfridges about twice in the whole of my life. I don't know why, but I it's not the sort of shop, really, which attracts male shoppers. But I would imagine you spend half your life in that store, yeah?
Well, I really don't. But a couple of weeks ago, I did have cause to go in for the first time in at least 2 years. I've always had a little ritual where I go, I wear a particular perfume that I can only buy in Selfridges.
Oh, yeah.
And usually on my birthday, I have this little ritual. I go into Selfridges and I buy this very expensive perfume, a bottle of it, which lasts me the entire year. But because I've not really been out as... you know, everybody else hasn't been out for the last 15 months or whatever. I've still got lots left of last year or the year before's. Mm-hmm. So I haven't had to buy any perfume. But there was something else I needed to get, which I could only buy in there.
Yeah.
So I did trot along Oxford Street a couple of weeks ago and went into Selfridges. And it was so bizarre. It was like going into a corner of Dubai on this very run-down, dilapidated street that used to be the sort of flagship street of London's shopping world, if you like. Oxford Street was quite glamorous when I was young, and I was a student sort of working in the back streets behind Oxford Circus. And now it's gone the other way. Lots of the shops are boarded up. Obviously, Debenhams is gone. A lot of the shops have been redeployed as sort of temporary... you know, cheap shops,
charity
really,
sort
of end of life, not really charity shops, but shops where lots of stuff is on sale for about £5.
I know, all piled up outside the front door.
Yeah, and then you go into Selfridges, and it's like this emporium, this sort of temple to excessive spending. It's all white and shiny and air conditioned, and you pick up a handbag and it's £9,000.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything is so expensive in there. It's almost like offensive, I found it, I'd have to say, because in these days of everybody struggling and jobs lost, money not coming in, it just felt like a symbol of excess and overspending. And I had a look around all the people who were in there shopping. Most of them didn't look as though they could afford the kind of stuff that was on sale in there. So maybe they were only having a look. But I was quite offended by it, and I did think about it for a few hours afterwards. What did I actually do in there? You know, apart from going in there, grabbing the item that I needed to buy. You can't even find the tills in there anymore. There aren't any. Yeah. You sort of wander up to this perfume counter and, oh, yes, you can pay here. But there aren't the signs around saying, you know, please queue nicely, please pay here, whatever. So it's turned into something very strange. I think go and have a look and see what you think.
Well,
and we'll talk about it again.
Yes. So you're talking about ostentatious consumption, are you? And
really very much. But you couldn't see people buying stuff because it's all too expensive to buy.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. I'm very sorry to hear about Oxford Street. Oxford Street's one of my favourite streets in the world.
Not anymore, it won't be.
Well, I'm just going to have a look. By the way, have you seen that hideous mound that they've put up at the end of Oxford Street near to Marble Arch?
Yeah, it's like a mountain. But I tell you what else, there's a lot of gangs. Gang members are obviously drawn to Oxford Street because people have clearly got credit cards and money on them, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Been quite a lot of stabbings along there in recent times. And here's something else there is none of.
Yeah.
Police officers.
Yeah, no, it doesn't surprise me at all. Well, that's a very sad story. My first ever job in radio at what was Talk Radio then, which turned into Talk Sport, was in Oxford Street. And that's where the studios were. And it was in like a media building. And I think I've told you this story before. I used to get in the lift in the mornings, and the other guy in there was Rowan Atkinson. And he never communicated with you at all. You know what I mean? You told me.
Oh, he doesn't. He does. I was on a train with him.
You told me.
2019, when we were going up to Liverpool. Hmm. And he deliberately sat in that seat just inside an intercity train.
Yes.
Where it's just one seat so that nobody can sit down next to you.
Yeah.
And we were all having breakfast the next day in the hotel all together. He just went over to the window and sat at a table by himself.
That's really rude, that, isn't it?
Yeah. Very rude, I thought. Yes, because there was Wayne Sleep jumping up and down the aisles, dancing with people and being very gregarious and joining in. If you're going to go to an event like that where lots of people expect you to be on and to be Rowan Atkinson and take part, you know, it's really, really rude just to turn up, accept your award and then kind of bugger off on the train back to London without talking to anybody.
No, I totally agree. I've got a few facts and figures here about Selfridges because I'm very fascinated about it. It's got what's called the Wonder Room. This is where the most expensive brands and items are sold, including jewellery and watches. The department was opened in 2007 by Stevie Wonder. One typical item.
Well, he couldn't see what was going on.
Oh, no, that's a bit harsh, Miss Jones.
Well, it's true, isn't it? It's true. Why get somebody like Stevie Wonder who can't actually see anything?
No, I know, but he's a massive international pop star, isn't he, with hit records. Anyway, it says posh goods such as a £52,200 white, gold and alligator embossed Chopard leather watch. No one knows existed.
Would you wear that?
Well, I wouldn't even know what it is. I didn't realise that Selfridges has nine restaurants in an apartment store, including the one on the top, which is called The Hive, which sells dishes made with honey from its own colony of bees, which get their pollen from nearby Green and Hyde Parks. This is all fascinating stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember when they just had that sort of... what's that? It's salt beef, isn't it? You get in New York. They had a salt beef bar in there.
Pastrami.
Which is very popular among the Jewish community of North London.
That's right.
I've had a few interviews in there over the years.
Yeah. Oh, well, I see. The most fascinating fact for me is that, did you ever see the TV series, Mr. Selfridge?
Yeah, I thought that was great. And I think it was, who was the chap? Oh, his name's gone out of my head.
American guy.
No, the guy who managed the Sex Pistols, Malcolm McLaren.
Oh, yes.
His mother had an affair with Mr. Selfridge.
Good God, you're joking.
No.
God, that's amazing. Because what I was going to say was, the most fascinating fact is that Mr. Selfridge actually lost control of the store when he got into bad business troubles. He was also an inveterate gambler and he used to spend his nights in the casinos in Park Lane nearby, which runs into Oxford Street. He lost all his money and he ended his life by strolling from his little one-bedroom flat down near Tottenham Court Road, up Oxford Street, past Selfridges with his name on the door, but he wasn't even allowed to go in because, you know, there were terrible business rows going on, how much money he still owed, but he'd lost control of the shop. And that's a terrible thing, isn't it, when you've built an empire like that?
It's such a common theme, and it happens sort of lower down the scale as well. A very good friend of mine who I used to work with at a record company, she went into a sort of her own business doing publicity with another person who is well known, so I won't say who it is, and she lent her name to the company, so they blended their names as the title of the new business. They didn't get on really. It lasted about 18 months and then she decided, I can't work with this guy anymore, and she left.
Right.
And she assumed that they would dissolve the company and that he would go off and do his own thing. No, he continued trading under her name. And she took him to court. It cost her a load of money. She never managed to get them to remove her name from his business. So to this day, people think that she still works with him. And whenever something goes wrong for him business-wise, people still blame her.
Good God, that's terrible, isn't it?
It's very common, that kind of thing.
That's the danger of getting into business with somebody else. If you do it on your own, I mean, you're an author, so you spend most of your life working on your own. And obviously you've got an agent and you've got publishers and all that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, if you work on your own, you're in control of your own destiny. When you work with somebody else, everything's great and everything's hunky-dory while it's going well. But when it goes wrong, the most disastrous things can happen. And, you know, terrible Decisions are made, monies are lost, friendships are broken, lawsuits can be, you know, appearing left, right and centre. It's really horrendous.
Yeah, it is. It's such a shame. The that show I was talking about, the TV drama, it was called The Ghosts of Oxford Street.
Oh, right. Okay.
And it was really evocative, really, really good show. Mm. I hope that comes around again sometime.
Well, funny you should talk about ghosts, because I was going to talk to you about ghosts as well, because the new Ghostbusters film is coming out. Who are you going to call? Ghostbusters, you know.
Oh, do you remember that? I used to do that little party piece. The woman who answered the phone in the Ghostbusters kind of office. Do you remember where they kept their trunk and everything?
Yes.
And the phone would ring. Yeah. It would ring and she'd pick it up and she'd go, "Hello, Ghostbusters." And then so they'd say whatever. And she'd put the phone down and then she'd turn around to the guys and go, "We got one."
Really, yeah, I kind of remember that. I
mean, you had to be there.
In the 80s, when I was in New York, I mean, it was the film, you know, that and Top Gun, I think, were the two films that...
Oh, I loved Ghostbusters. It was absolutely brilliant. And also brilliant, when we lived in New York, was going around and seeing the buildings where the kind of monsters and yes, all the kind of those really terrible ghouls used to come out the top of them and stuff, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah.
And I'd point them out to my kids and go, "Oh, look at that building over there. That's where that kind of purple one came out the top and stuff."
Yeah, no, absolutely true. What I didn't know was that either Dan Aykroyd or Bill Murray, and I can't remember which one it was now, had the original idea from the film because they were brought up in a haunted house and, you know, were conscious of ghosts, whichever one it was, all their life, and just turned it into a film. I didn't know that until I read the story about the new film.
Do you think a haunted house is a real thing?
Well, I was going to ask you that because there's a lady called Jo Elvin and she's the editor of You magazine, okay?
Yeah, she's good, actually. She writes a very nice sort of letter from the editor at the beginning of the magazine.
Yes, I agree. And she wrote one 2 or 3 weeks ago about, you know, the perils of being the mother of teenage children and all that kind of stuff. I think she's, you know, got a finger on the button. But you'll have seen the piece she wrote then in her last edition where she went to look over a house, which she and her husband were intending to buy, and she could hear banging doors and people running up and down the stairs, but she never saw anybody. She just heard these noises, and she's absolutely determined to this day that that house must have been haunted and she couldn't get out of it quickly enough. I've never had a ghostly experience, have you?
No, that sounds to me like the people next door making a noise or something. I've never had an experience. I think that ghostly mythology arose in the days when people were less educated. Mm. Science didn't exist, not really. And it's the sound of a door closing inexplicably, had to be the work of some kind of ghoul, an unseen malevolent. But I've never experienced anything like this myself in all my years on the planet.
Mm.
And I think I'd have to have a personal experience to be convinced. You read about these things and you think, nah, not really.
No, I totally agree. You know, I don't know what it is, but some things are inexplicable, but the inexplicable has only ever come to me in a written piece. You see what I mean? You know, walking down a country road and all of a sudden an old woman coming the other way, you know what I mean? And then the old woman hunched over her stick, stopped and stared and then turned around and she disappeared, all those kind of things, you know. I think most ghost experiences are just natural phenomena of the light or the wind or the rustling of the trees or something like that.
And people take advantage of vulnerable people in those situations.
Yeah, they do.
Do you remember that psychic so-called woman, Doris Stokes?
Yes, I do, yes.
Who had a massive following all around the country.
Yeah.
And years later, after she died, I was researching my book about Mark Bolan and interviewing somebody or other who told me that this particular driver that Mark had at one point became a manager of Doris Stokes.
Yeah.
And this guy actually fed details to Doris about Mark Bolan's death.
Right.
And then set up a psychic reading with Mark Bolan's mother.
Mm.
And it was all very cynical because this Doris was feeding all this information. And so Mark's mother was convinced that she was in touch with him on the other side. I think there's something very distasteful about things like that.
I think it's awful, shocking. We used to, as kids, did you ever play on the Ouija board when you're...
Did it once and frightened the life out of ourselves.
And you have your fingers on a glass and the glass moves around the middle of the table, but you can never work out who's actually pushing the glass, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I used to push it. That was the thing. I did the pushing. But then I think I frightened myself because you shouldn't play with things you don't understand.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. Well, on a lighter note and a brighter note, I've got a list here and it's... Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive has been voted greatest ever breakup song. Well, I think we all could have guessed that, couldn't we? Because we've spoken before about how, you know, whenever a relationship goes wrong and a woman's famous, she always appears on a dance floor somewhere dancing to I Will Survive, doesn't she?
I wouldn't call it a breakup song, though. I would call that a survival song.
Really?
Because there are much better breakup songs, and breakup songs ought to be quite mournful and sad. So there are better songs than that. Etta James's I'd Rather Go Blind, which is a kind of a miserable classic. I Will Always Love You, Whitney Houston, that's an amazing song, isn't it? Well, what about Gladys Knight, Neither One of Us? The Righteous Brothers, You Lost That Loving Feeling. These are more...
Loving Feeling.
That one, yes.
That loving feeling.
We digress. I think those are more authentic breakup songs, I think. Would you not say? Always got carried away now.
Yeah, when your lips touch mine. Well, anyway, I don't know much about it, but I've got the list here. They're defending Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive on the line, I've got all my life to live and go now, go, walk out the door. So that's why they say it's a survival song. But
yeah, no, they're saying it's a breakup song, and I think it's a survival song.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. Well, the other ones listed here are Bill Withers, Ain't No Sunshine. Ain't No Sunshine, that's a very mournful.
Yeah, that's mournful. Yeah, that's a good one.
Fleetwood Mac, Go Your Own Way.
No, that's much more upbeat, I would say.
I agree as well. Roy Orbison, Crying.
Yeah, that's a good one. Good choice.
Crying over you. And all these songs. Carly Simon's You're So Vain. I wouldn't put that as...
No, not a breakup song. Definitely not.
That's just a great song, you know, full of the mystery of who the subject of the song is and has been.
Yeah. And she's never really said, has she? You know who that is on backing vocals on that song, by the way?
Oh, is it Mick Jagger?
That is Mick Jagger, and it's said that they were having an affair at the time. Oh, but she slept with everyone, and he's obviously slept with everyone, so I'd be surprised if they recognised each other.
Well, that's a bit harsh, isn't it? She, of course, is, and I'm sure I've told you this before, she is the Simon from the publishers Simon & Schuster.
Yes, that was her father's business, I think.
That's right. Yeah, she's the daughter of time.
She was absolutely gorgeous when she was young.
Yeah. Well, I saw her in a documentary.
I saw a documentary not long ago, and she looked really quite elderly and dodgy. I mean, we all get there, obviously, but it was sad to see her like that.
Yes.
When I remembered her in her sort of very glowing prime.
Yeah. Oh, right. Well, okay. And just the rest, just to finish off.
Yeah, go on.
Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You. We've talked about that. Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares to You. I love that song.
That's so you know who wrote that song?
Prince.
Yeah. But I think her rendition of it was preferable.
Beautiful and mournful. Then Al Green, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? I can't even remember that one.
No, I can't.
Yeah, Carole King, It's Too Late, It's Too Late. I suppose that's a breakup song, isn't it?
It's Too Late, Baby, Now It's Too Late. Yeah, then we really did try to make it. I think she wrote that with her husband, Jerry Goffin, who she was breaking up from at the time.
Oh, blimey, that's an honour. And the last one, Adele, Someone Like You. I've never really heard any Adele songs except for her.
Someone Like You, that is quite sad, yeah. What was the Al Green song you mentioned?
Al Green, Fleetwood Mac, Whitney Houston. Al Green, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart?
Okay, I'm going to look that one up after the show.
I remember one song when I was going out with a young lady in my sort of late teens and we kind of split up for a bit. And the song at the time was it Bill Withers? Hey, did you happen to see the most beautiful...
No, that was Charlie Rich.
Charlie Rich, that's right. Yeah, thank you, yeah.
And, my father was a big fan of Charlie Rich.
Oh, right, okay. And anyway, this young lady got her mate to come round and give me a copy of that record. You know, it was like a token of love, a message, you know what I mean?
Why'd she get her mate to do it?
Well, because, you know, we'd broken up and she thought a mate was playing matchmaker, you see what I mean? And,
oh,
and
God. Don't you think all those kind of things are really seedy? If it's like when somebody used to say to someone, go across the room and tell the guy, my mate fancies you.
Yes,
that happened to me all the time. Cringe, no,
that, honest to God, that used to happen to me all the time at parties, you know, when you're in somebody's house and the lights were low and all that. So my mate wants to know if you'll go out with her, you know?
Oh, no.
The problem was, in a darkened room, and this sounds awful, you couldn't really tell if they were any good looking or not. You know what I mean?
Oh, you're so shallow. Yeah. My son took me out for dinner the other night. We had a really nice evening. Right. And then we popped into a bar that he goes to. And this girl came over to ask what we'd like to drink and so on. And as she crept away, he said the classic happened in here the other night. So what was that? He said she brought me my bill and it had her phone number written on the top.
No.
Yeah.
Well, the waitress had put her phone number on the top.
The waitress, to give to my son. And he looked at me as he said, still got it, mama.
Yeah. Yeah, of course he has. That's right. Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for tuning in to this latest edition of Life on Planet Porky. It will be the last one for a few weeks, as we've already mentioned, and we'll be back with you in, well, not the autumn, but certainly September. We've decided to take a few weeks' break. Speaking for myself, it's because we've been cooped up for so long. I want to get out and about and get around the coastline of Britain. And, of course, Miss Jones, you've got your own plans, haven't you?
It's a bit up in the air at the moment because of everybody else's plans, exactly. I suppose. But and also work things keep changing all the time.
Yes.
Nothing's set in stone anymore. Everything feels like a movable feast.
Mm-hmm.
We might not actually get to Italy because it's looking as though the kids won't be able to get out of their various jobs and stuff at the moment.
Yeah.
But it's all right. I've got so much to do.
Exactly. It's fine. Together. Yes, absolutely. By the way, I didn't realise when we just mentioned Mick Jagger there singing the background vocals on You're So Vain, he's actually 78 this week. He's still wearing pretty well, isn't he? But I don't want to see the Rolling Stones back on the road again. I'm sure I saw a publicity picture for them getting together again for some tour. I think it's obscene now to see people verging on 80 cavorting around on a stage with guitars. It's rubbish. It's nonsense.
I think that's disgustingly ageist of you, Michael.
Yeah, well, it is. Yeah, I agree. But, you know, I think if you go and watch a bunch of 80-year-olds cavorting around the stage, there's something wrong with you as well as them. Who would?
You're missing the point. I think
spectacle. Possibly find that a spectacle, eh?
You are missing the point. So you might as well say that an actor of great age shouldn't be, say, Ian McKellen, for example, shouldn't be presenting himself on a theatrical stage because he's too old to be doing it.
No, I'm not saying that. And you're talking about Sir Ian McKellen because he's taken a part as Hamlet in a production now. And Hamlet, you know, King of Denmark and all that, is usually played by a younger man. But that's drama, that's acting. The Rolling Stones are real. They used to be a real pop group of young men in their early 20s who stormed the world of music and rock and roll. They shouldn't still be doing it 60 years later because
why not?
Because they're not young men anymore.
Who's to say that it's the preserve of the young?
Well, look, the sounds they made were historic and wonderful and will live forever, just like all the other great music of the 60s and 70s and 80s will live forever. But they shouldn't be on stage trying to replicate it. And it never sounds like the same record anyway, because their voices are not the same and their energy is not the same playing their musical instruments anyway.
Oh, that's terribly ageist of you, Michael. I
agree.
The thing about rock and roll is that the live performance, the live experience, is not meant to be an exact rendition of the recorded sound. It's an interpretation of the song.
Well,
it's a much better experience in my experience.
Yeah. No, I don't want an interpretation. I want it to sound like what it sounded like when they made it in the studio and I was
You absolute Philistine.
Yeah, I'm a Philistine, I agree.
No, I disagree with you entirely. I think that what we're really saying, if Mick Jagger is 78, they're all sort of knocking 80. Charlie Watts is already 80. Age is no longer even a number. It's utterly irrelevant.
Hmm.
It's all to do with doing what you do for as long as possible. Look at the Queen compared to most 95-year-olds.
Hmm.
She's up, she's out there, she's opening things, she's turning up, she's doing her job. What were you saying, that the Queen is too old to be doing what she does?
No, I'm not. But the queen is the queen, and the monarch grows old, and then she adapts to her lifestyle and her ability to do her job as she gets older. I just
well, that's what the stones are doing.
Well, yeah, but they're nothing like what they were, and frankly, well,
neither are you, neither am I. No, but that's not to say we can't keep soldiering on.
No, but I don't pretend to be a rock star. And what's more... What's
oh, my
more,
goodness, you are so ageist.
I am. And what's more, I think they're cheating the public by asking them to pay £200 for a good seat at one of their live concerts to watch something which is one-third as good as it should be. But anyway,
and you base that judgment on what exactly? When was the last time you saw them live?
I don't go to live concerts because I don't enjoy them. I've never enjoyed them.
So you
them.
Don't know that the Stones are cheating their audience?
No, I do, because although I haven't been to live concerts, I've seen plenty of footage of the Stones live in concert and thought, wow, what a tin-eared sound that is. It's really sound melodic, you know?
Well, yeah. I have to say, as long as they continue to perform live,
yeah,
I will turn up and enjoy it.
Oh, right, okay. Well, that's because you're a freeloader. You know, you always
go... No, I always buy my tickets. Yeah. How very dare you? I always pay for my tickets.
Yeah, is that right?
I'm not a freeloader whatsoever.
Oh, really? Isn't that interesting, Ms. Jones? Do you pay for your ticket the other night when we were at the Odeon Theatre in Leicester
Square? No, because you invited me.
Okay,
you invited me, and I know you didn't pay for the tickets.
Excuse me, you know, I am a valued guest, you see, so...
Oh, is that what it is? Guest, yeah. Okay, guest.
Anyway, away from that for a minute, I want to talk to you about a real peril which lies ahead in this country and something everybody should be aware of, and that is the danger of being bitten by a tick and the terrible, terrible consequences of something called Lyme disease. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do, because I have a friend who I used to see a lot of, but she moved out of London to Brighton.
Yeah.
And her son, Charlie, is the same age as my son.
Mm.
They had thought for years that he was bitten by a tick and had Lyme disease.
Right.
There's no accepted clinical definition of chronic Lyme disease, which they believe Charlie was suffering from all these years.
Right.
And after about more than 10 years...
Yeah.
Of him living this life that was sort of in the twilight zone, fever, muscle soreness, headaches, dizziness, fatigue,
all of this,
which is said to be the symptoms. It turned out that he didn't have Lyme disease after all. And the vast majority of people diagnosed with it don't have it either. So it's leading the medical profession to question whether it even exists.
Really? Well, what is it if it's not Lyme disease?
Well, this is the point. It's a bit like ME. You know,
right,
people have this condition called ME, and also repetitive strain injury, these kinds of things, which there is no exact diagnosis for. Mm. So are people actually suffering from it? Or could it be, say, in the case of Lyme's disease, could it be something like Crohn's disease, which has similar symptoms? There is a bacterium called Borrelia burgdorferi, which is said to cause it, but they don't have enough research or information to prove that it really exists.
Yeah. One thing I think that is clear, and by the way, you've outlined it really well about the mystery of Lyme disease, does it exist? But it is transmitted by ticks, isn't it? And often those ticks are on deer. Now, for many, many years, I've walked across both the North and South Downs. More on the North Downs, you find deer. You know, you see them, you know, in the edge of fields and all that kind of stuff. And then I got to learn about Lyme disease and I thought, this is not good. So I won't walk in fields anymore for fear of getting it. If I do and have to be in that sort of area, I urge everybody, wear long sleeve shirts and wear long trousers. Because when you do get bitten, it might not be Lyme disease, but it's very, very unpleasant.
I think when you get bitten by a mosquito as well, that can be very unpleasant. I seem to be allergic to mosquito bites and I never get just an itchy little bite. I always get something egg-sized and very red and sore. And I saw my mum the other day. She wasn't very well for about 3 days.
Right.
And she was having the dizziness, the sickness, the vomiting, all that kind of stuff. And she said to me that day, oh, I think I've been bitten. Mm. She hadn't been outside the door. So any insect could have got in. And if you think about it, all insects have the potential to carry disease, don't they?
They do, yeah.
So a mosquito bite probably can carry the same kind of bacteria as these ticks do.
Or malaria.
Yeah, well, that, of course, yeah. Store, yeah. You're not going to get that in the UK, I suppose, unless somebody brings back a mosquito with malaria in its bloodstream a far-flung country. No. I suppose it's possible.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been bitten by a mosquito. If I have, I'm not aware of it, you know.
Oh, but you would be. It's disgusting. Really horrible.
I wonder why they come after you.
I've got very sweet blood.
Oh, right. How do they know that?
I've been told.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
no.
I'm sure there is a scent that you give off. You have the sort of blood that they're after, yeah. Bloodsuckers, I'm surrounded by them.
Bloodsuckers, that's right. Now is Jones. Excuse me, sorry, I was twisting my head there. You and I have been in our profession for many, many years, but we had different starts to it. You kind of got into the business through the sort of rock and roll PR type path. I got into it through the weekly newspaper path. I first job was on my local hometown newspaper, the Chester Chronicle, and I've read a review of a book, and it's called "Panic as Man Burns Crumpets: The Vanishing World of the Local Journalist," and it's written by a guy who worked on the Carlisle News and Star, another little local newspaper up in the Lake District, really, or certainly Cumbria, and he tells of the joys of, you know, small town newspaper writing when everybody knows everybody and, you know, the intimacy of going to see the vicar and, you know, the reporting on the, you know, the local church fate and all that kind of stuff. And I have to say, I did it for 2.5 years and it was utterly charming, honestly, to sort of immerse yourself in your local community and feel like, you know, you were part of everything that went on in the town and all that. I really loved it.
Yeah, I never worked on a local paper, but I do miss the local papers.
Yes.
They do seem to have vanished into thin air, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
But it was very particular news and it was always something you were interested in because, as you say, it was about people you knew. I missed out on that experience. I think most journalists in America start out on local papers.
That's because there are only local newspapers, you see.
Of course, they're regional newspapers rather than local, aren't they? But a friend of my father's actually owned a local newspaper somewhere in the Midwest that his father had started.
Right.
So I thought that would have been rather a nice experience. But they are something to miss. Websites are not the same
Websites aren't the same. And then, you know, we all get together in the pub on a Thursday night when you get paid and have a few sherbets and all that kind of stuff. And you get into the local football ground free because you're a reporter on the local paper and all that. The best benefit for me was I started going out with a young lady, you know, about halfway through my time on the Chester Chronicle, and a new club had just opened in town in Chester called, I think it was called the King's Disco or something like that, you know, or the Barley High or something like that. They called it the Barley High. I'm sure they did. And I'd gone to the opening night representing the paper, you know, and got 2 free tickets and all that kind of stuff, and then did a big write-up on it. And the next time I went, I was able to walk right to the front of the queue with this new young lady of mine and knock on the door with everybody staring at me thinking, what's he doing? And then the door opened and the manager said, oh, yes, Mr. Parry, come in, please. And then he said to one of the bouncers, you know, please escort Mr. Parry upstairs to the restaurant and buy him and his young lady a meal and give them some drinks. And I thought, wow, this is a great job. I'm going to do this forever.
Is there a kind of freeloading mentality going on here, Michael?
Very much so. I tell you another interesting thing as well. When you start in a weekly newspaper, you are one of two sorts of young reporter. You are either determined that you're going to make it and get to Fleet Street and work on the Daily Express and travel the world and be a correspondent in America, or you are literally so comforted by the warmth of the place and the, you know, the family type feeling, and you've got a cushy job which you can do for the rest of your life. You can be like that and just go through your career that way. And just to illustrate the contrast, I was of the first sort, and, you know, without sounding big-headed, I achieved most of what I wanted to do in newspapers. And I started on the same day as a guy called Paul, and I can't remember his surname now. But he was totally of the opposite view. When I used to talk about my ambitions to work on an evening newspaper, you know, go to the Manchester Evening News or something like that, he was always, what do you want to do that for? it's grand round here. You know, you should stay here. This is the life. It's great. It's, you know, we don't get up in the mornings nervous. We're not challenged by anything. It's easy. And I said, yes, but it's too easy. Anyway, literally about 30 years later, I don't know how I found out, but I read a piece somewhere, it must have been in the UK Press Gazette, as it was in those days, that Paul, the guy I started with on the same day, 30 years later, he'd just been made editor of the Chester Chronicle. And I just thought to myself, well, he got what he wanted and I got what I wanted. But they were two totally different ambitions, you know?
Horses for courses. Yeah, there's all kinds of journalism, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely.
Anyway, do you remember Roger, talking of Roger Tavener, as we tend always to do, yes. He ended up back on the Western Daily Press.
Yes, that's right. He did.
Having been one of Fleet Street's finest all those years.
He was a feature writer, wasn't he? Didn't he go back as a feature writer or something?
Yeah, I think he did, yeah. And he's in Australia now, of course, working as a photographer.
Yeah, well, very good luck to Rog. Hope it's going well. And if you listen to this, Rog, make sure you get back here soon and we can have a sherbet. Now, during the course of one of my journalistic adventures, I think it was when I was on the... Where would it have been? Must have been on the Birmingham Evening Mail, I think, or the Newcastle Evening Chronicle. But Princess Margaret came to town, okay? And she was opening like a factory or something, you know, or something like that. And
the Royal Slapper, as they used to call her.
Well, the reason I'm telling you this, I've just read this piece in the last couple of days in a newspaper. Princess Margaret apparently got so drunk at a marathon five-hour piss-up during a Royal Variety performance that she fell while greeting performers after the show.
Recalled
actress Sherry Hewson, she laughed with such gusto she tripped in her high heels and the very handsome Howard Keel caught her. Do you remember Howard Keel?
Oh, he was in Dallas.
He was
he a big musical theatre star at one point? He was. On Broadway, yeah.
He was apparently very famous, very handsome, and he ended up as Miss Ellie's second husband.
Yeah, he was really big compared to her, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, yeah.
I used to look at those two and think, how does that work? I suppose it all works lying down.
Well, Miss Jones, honestly, for goodness sake.
That's your dirty mind, not mine.
No. Anyway, it just makes the point here that Princess Margaret was the only royal who was ever determined to enjoy a royal variety performance because they were so deadly boring and dull. But on the reason I mentioned it in relation to my work was she turned up at this factory once, or I don't know what it was, opening something, and it was like a traditional Royal Bentley. And they opened the back door and she fell out onto the road. I'm not joking.
What a girl. And,
you know, of course, terrible embarrassment for all the royal aides and all that, picking her up. She was clearly completely discombobulated. You know, she couldn't make her arms and legs coordinate. And then they just picked her up, hustled her back into the car, and the car drove off and we never saw her again.
That's very funny. I was going to say they shouldn't even have opened the door. They should have just driven her back to barracks.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And that was the end of it. Now, Miss Jones, what do we know about the group Doreen? Apparently they're celebrating 30 years of being together, but they are a very, very lucky pop group, aren't they? Because they're actually only famous for one record that only got to number 5, but... because it was adopted by Alistair Campbell, who was Tony Blair's, you know, top spin doctor, kind of hard man, it's a world-famous record.
Well, it's not quite as simple as that. D-Ream, as they pronounce themselves, are actually only one person. This guy, Peter Cooner, who's the sort of lead singer, he's the only permanent member of the band. And the rest of it is session musicians who come in and kind of do the recording sessions and also the live shows. For years, people have said that the keyboard player was Brian Cox, who's now the cosmologist and TV presenter, who everybody fancies. But in fact, Brian only played keys with them live a few times. It was Peter Cooner himself who played keys on the studio recordings. So Brian Cox wasn't even part of the band proper, if you like. But yeah, they did have that exposure with their song Things Can Only Get Better.
Things Can Only Get Better.
Great song. Can and it was picked up for Tony Blair's election campaign, wasn't it? And did very well for them. But no, they were never an official band. So I think that's worth mentioning.
Amazing. So the guy you're talking about Was he the one who sang that song then? Things Can
Yeah, Peter Cooney, yeah.
Right. So he's, oh, I see, yeah, amazing. So kind of one-man band.
But like, they did, no, not really. They did a one-man band, yes, but they did, they weren't one-hit wonders. Oh. They had 8 top 40 hits and 3 hit albums. So, you know, we shouldn't write them off as a one-hit wonder, I think.
No, all right, that's a bit unfair. Anyway, there we are. Right, okay, folks, that's it. And that's it for the summer, so to speak. We will be back in September. I hope by then, by the way, Miss Jones, we really will have broken the back of COVID. You know, some newspaper headlines this week have actually suggested it is all over now. And we've had to put up with, you know, sort of wild and crazy differing predictions about how many people are going to get it each day and all that. So I hope in a month's time, when we get back together again, Miss Jones, return to life on Planet Porky, that the world will be a better place.
I tell you what, if we get back in the studio by September, we are going to have such a lunch.
Yeah, I tell you, not just such a lunch, we're going to have such a new podcast to return to. And the thing called Levels, folks, which is the parity or disparity in the voices of Miss Jones and I, much easier to do it in the studio, believe me, than doing it in 2 studios. So we're looking forward to that as well. So until September, everybody, from me, the Portmeister, cheerio and have a great August.
See you anon.
Indeed. I was spraying railway platforms with weed killer, right, to keep the, you know, the weeds down on the platform. The only reason I did that, because it was a horrible job, you know, the chemicals, again, smelt awful and all that. But I got my own truck, my own chemical truck. And so I had a new girlfriend at the time. She wasn't that impressed when I came round the first night to take her out with the chemical truck. And we went off to some country pub, you know, in Cheshire. And I have to say, my vehicle was quite outstanding in the car park alongside the old MGB Roadsters, you know.
You probably poisoned the poor girl with all these chemicals pouring off you and sweating away in the moonlight.
Well, you know, we won't go into that. What a tin-eared sound that is. It's really melodic, you know.
Well, yeah. I have to say, as long as they continue to perform live, I will turn up and enjoy it.
Oh, right, OK. Well, that's because you're a freeloader. You know, you always
go... No, I always buy my tickets. Yeah. How very dare you? I always pay for my tickets.
Yeah, is that right?
I'm not a freeloader whatsoever.
Oh, really? Isn't that interesting, Miss Jones? Did you pay for your ticket the other night when we were at the Odeon Theatre in Leicester
Square? No, because you invited me.
Oh, okay,
you invited me, and I know you didn't pay for the tickets.
Excuse me, you know, I am a valued guest, you see, so...
Oh, is that what it is? Guest, yeah.
And anyway, this young lady got her mate to come round and give me a copy of that record. You know, it's like a token of love, a message, you know what I mean?